Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough, and today on the program, we are talking about the Democratic National Convention, about charges being dropped against former Utah Attorney General Mark Shurtleff. Also, Governor Gary Herbert speaks out against the bear's ears, and teachers give the state school board an earful. Those and other stories on the docket today. Joining me in the studio this morning, Salt Lake Tribune justice reporter Jennifer Dobner. Good morning, Jennifer.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Government editor Dan Harry is with us as well. Hi, Dan, and good morning.
Good morning.
And joining us via the phone is Salt Lake Tribune Washington correspondent Thomas Burr. Welcome, Tommy.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning. Listeners, you can join this conversation as well. Put your comments and questions in the comments section at sltrib.com or call us up at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Well, to begin with, some history was made as Hillary Clinton became the first female presidential nominee of a major political party. And Tommy Burr, you were there in Philadelphia to see it happen, as were delegates from the Utah Democratic Party. Several days of speakers, and I guess a major theme beyond, you know, history being made was that of unity, both party unity and American unity.
Yeah, I think that was the goal. First, I should say that the theme should have been "Make Sleep Great Again." I've heard of the sleep thing. I'm going to try it soon. I really like that idea. So, yes, of course, the idea of the convention here, Democrats, was unity. There's obviously been a divisive and somewhat bitter election between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. And the idea was, okay, we'll let him speak on Monday night. And during the actual roll call vote, when they were going to, of course, end up voting for Hillary Clinton as the nominee, Bernie Sanders interrupted the vote at the very end and said, you know, thank you, record the vote, but let's do this by acclamation, so by a voice vote of everyone in the hall. Bernie Sanders, the idea was to bring the Bernie Sanders people aboard the Hillary train, headed into November, and have the party, you know, believe and then look, appear as one. Unfortunately, that really didn't happen in some ways because there were several protests. A lot of people walked out. Even last night, as Hillary Clinton was giving her acceptance speech, you know, one of these big moments in history, the first woman in a major party ticket actually accepting the nomination. There were still people chanting Bernie, Bernie. And I'm not even kidding, during a prayer at one point, they were chanting Bernie.
Wow. You know, you mentioned the acclamation, the delegates being, well, the nomination by acclamation, but there was also a moment when Utah Democrats had their moment to deliver essentially the message that they had to the nation and how many delegates they were awarding. Utah Democratic Party Chairman Peter Caroon announced to the Utah delegate count, and actually most of those delegates ended up going to Bernie Sanders. Is that right?
That, of course, yes. And Utah voted, Utah Democrats voted 80% for Bernie. So nearly 80% were in favor of him. So, you know, it's obviously a very big Bernie state. I should call him Senator Sanders, but right. Let's go with Bernie for the moment. Yes, and so 29 of Utah's 37 delegates went to Bernie Sanders. The other 8 went to Hillary Clinton, including a couple super delegates there, of course. And actually, that was one of the ideas behind the party unity, was to let them actually vote for Bernie and Clinton and not just one of them. And that did not happen. The Republicans, in some ways, yes, they did have the vote where they were split between Kasich and Cruz and Trump. But in this case, they let them vote that as so they could understand that, yes, their votes were being counted, even if in the end of the day they did not have enough votes to get Bernie over the top.
You know, I want to come back around to that idea of party unity, but, you know, both Republican and Democratic Party unity. A quick reminder to listeners that you can join this conversation with your calls at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. We'd love to hear your comments. But I don't want to skip over the fact that, you know, history was made here. And actually, Jennifer Dobner, I might bring you in on this conversation because maybe you can kind of step out of your role as a reporter for a moment and I think you can remain nonpartisan and still answer this question, which is, what does it mean to you as a woman to have a woman now be this close to the presidency?
Well, what's interesting, they would ask that. I've been having a lot of conversations with my women friends and with a couple of men in the newsroom about this, and some of whom
Right, go on.
I think I'm having an audio problem.
Oh, yeah, no worries. No
worries. There we go. Sorry. And there's a little bit of debate among some about whether or not gender matters. And I don't know if gender matters in terms of decision making, but I think gender does matter in terms of the optics and the message that that sends. I'm of a generation in which I was told I couldn't drive a stick shift and I probably should get married when I got out of college. And so in my family and, you know, the opportunities seem less, you know, more limiting for women. And I think that my nieces, who are 15 and 16 right now, now see a totally different picture of what's possible. So for me, that really feels significant.
Well, and it's not, I mean, the right to vote for women is not that old.
97 years, in case you were wondering.
And we've had 44 male presidents. It seems like a historic moment, definitely.
Yeah, so I would say this, that I think that women have made great progress. Certainly, my mother's generation, even my generation, we do way more than many before us. But you don't really change the conversation for everybody in the room unless everybody has an equal opportunity to sit at the big table. And now,
you know, that was actually one of the points that Hillary made last night, that I think was one of her more salient lines in her speech, was that when you break down, when you get rid of a barrier for one, you get sort of rid of barriers for all. And I think that was the theme she tried to play, talking what Jennifer was saying there, is that, you know, talking about being black people being able to go into a cafe and sit down and have a cup of coffee, to, you know, women being able to vote, to electing a woman as a Republican or, sorry, Democratic nominee, then you allow other people in other places, be gay, LGBTQ, or racial lines are erased.
Right. Well, and you know, again, this is, I guess, history being made. And there's something else that I kind of want to bring into this, which is the fact that during this election cycle, there have been a lot of divisions that have been exposed, not necessarily over gender or racial lines. But when you look at the liberals and conservative movements in America, a lot of Facebook falling out over the election. That's what I'm seeing, at least when it comes to you know, seeing people fight over their party's nominee and who they would rather see as their party's nominee, be it Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump. And for many Utahns, the Republican delegates, of course, ended up going to Ted Cruz, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right, Tommy?
Yeah, of course. Senator Cruz obviously won Utah's primary as well. So similar, but in both conventions, we had delegates from Utah who were going to, you had Cruz delegates going to a Trump convention, you had Bernie delegates going to a Hillary convention. And I think it's definitely hard for some people to be so passionate about a candidate and then come to the national convention where their candidate is not the winner. Especially hard for some people who are very new to politics. And I think we saw that this week with some of the Bernie Sanders supporters who are, you know, so much believe in their candidate and have been working so hard for their candidate, and to see, you know, him denied the nomination. I believe there were several Bernie Sanders supporters from Utah and other places who came to Philadelphia believing they could actually wrest control of the convention and elect their guy as the nominee. And that's just not how it works,
right,
necessarily in American politics.
So, Tommy, I have a question for you. I'm wondering about the sort of Bernie impact on Utah's Democratic Party. There was a huge turnout here, you know, on primary day, and I'm wondering, are those people going to stay, and is that really going to have an effect on where the party goes?
Well, I think it's up to the party. The party really has to figure out how now to bring those people in and make them feel home in the Democratic Party, that it wasn't just a one-off, that they don't just disappear into the ether now that they've been around and interested in politics and believe in a cause. So the Democratic Party really has to understand now how to bring them into the fold and make them feel worthwhile. I think you saw that in the platform being changed at the Democratic Convention, for example, the $15 minimum wage, the idea that if your family makes less than $125,000, I think that was the figure, that you could get go to college for free. Those kind of things are brought into the platform to appease the Bernie Sanders supporters and then keep them involved. Because as we all know, one of the demographics that votes the least and is least involved in politics is kind of the 18 to 24 era that Bernie really hit on and brought in for the first time in their lives. And they could be lifelong Democrats if the Democratic Party is able to appeal to that.
Well, and I'm wondering, it seems like a lot of that would have been on Hillary Clinton last night actually making a speech that appeals to these people, to people who have been disaffected by the party since, the sort of, I don't know if you want to call it disaffection, but what happened to Bernie during this campaign. I know that, as you said, that there were Utahns who were involved in disruptions in Philadelphia. There were some protests in Philadelphia at the convention, and I'm just wondering if you think, Tommy, that there was enough sort of healing in that party for there to be real unity.
Yeah, the healing, there'll still be some to come. I think there's still plenty of work to do. I talked to several delegates from Utah who came as Bernie Sanders fans. We're leaving as Bernie Sanders fans, but are still going to vote for Hillary Clinton. And I think Sanders actually said that yesterday when he spoke right to the Utah delegation, West Virginia, Hawaii. There was a bunch of delegations staying in this hotel. And Sanders said, look, you've got to elect Hillary. We don't want Donald Trump, but the revolution starts again the day after we elect Hillary. He's pretty much saying we're not letting this go. But there's still some ways to go with some people who last night wore fluorescent shirts, and a lot of them, they didn't walk out as we kind of expected them to, but a lot of them held signs that said Jill Stein, which is the Green Party nominee, essentially saying they're leaving the Democratic Party and going to vote for Jill Stein. There were a lot of protests and catcalls during the Hillary speech from people who are disaffected, who were not going to stay in the Democratic Party. But that probably is a small percentage of those. It seems at the end that they were able to win people over for the most part, at least those at the convention. I think overall in the larger Democratic electorates, they're going to stop this work.
Okay. Well, again, listeners, we'd love to hear from you on this number to call 801-355-8255. You can also go to the Salt Lake Tribune's website and place your comments there. Again, a promise, as you said, Tommy, yesterday at that breakfast from Bernie Sanders to, take the fight forward after the election. But in the meantime, he is there endorsing the nominee now, Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, so here's the question. How much work does he do now? Does he go out? Is he going to be a surrogate for Clinton? It was clearly that he didn't say this stuff at the convention because he, they were giving him some concessions on the platform and such. But really, to make this move forward, they're going to need Bernie Sanders to run to Utah a few times and say, hey, guys, work with me to run to Nevada, to run to Colorado, do some of those states where he did really strongly, and bring his people aboard the Hillary train.
All right. Well, Tommy, between the Republican and Democratic conventions, you and Matt Canham, did you guys keep a tally of how many stories you published? It seemed like a bit of a feeding frenzy. I'm curious.
Well, I know I'm sure my boss Dan Harriet did at some point. I don't think we kept the tally. I am disappointed in myself, however, because I only ate three cheesesteaks while I was in Philadelphia. Only three, and that's probably a good thing, but I maybe need to get another one on the way out of town.
Actually, I'm only counting one story, and that's the one that Tommy still owes me for the weekend. So
I knew he would mention that.
Editors never let up.
Well, if it helps at all, we have a comment here from a caller who called in who is a C-SPAN junkie. This is King from Salt Lake City, who thinks that Thomas Burr is doing a great job. So somebody who sees you on C-SPAN frequently, Tommy.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. Just include the and needs a raise thing every time you comment about that, right?
That would be two raises. I want one, too.
Well, as long as we're asking. Listeners, we're going to have to take actually our first break here. But when we return, we will discuss charges being dismissed against former Utah Attorney General Mark Shurtleff. You are listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW in the Greater Salt Lake Valley and throughout the state on Utah Public Radio. We'll be back in a moment.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Utah Festival in Logan presents Broadway, opera concerts, and chamber music. including Bach, Mass in B minor, and more. July 6th through August 6th, 139 events, Music in the Mountains. Details at utahfestival.org.
I'm Robin Young. As we get ready to leave Philly, we'll visit the house where Edgar Allan Poe wrote one of his spookiest stories.
On top of her head, solitary eye of fire, red extended mouth, I had walled the monster inside the tomb.
Next time, here and now.
Join us this morning at 11 on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines, the Salt Lake Tribune Reporter News Roundup, heard on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough, joined in studio by the Salt Lake Tribune's Dan Harry and Jennifer Dobner, and we are looking into this past week's news. Again, you can join this conversation commenting at the Behind the Headlines page, currently live at sltrib.com, or calling us at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. And Jennifer Dobner, a story that you reported on this week, charges against former Utah Attorney General Mark Shurtleff have been dismissed. Remind us of the charges that he was facing and then tell us why they were dropped.
Well, so there were five felonies and two misdemeanors, all related to allegations of public corruption, accepting improper gifts as a public official. Oh, I think one was bribery in exchange for doing, I forget exactly the language, but doing a favor for someone, obstruction of justice, those types of things. The dismissal itself, not really a surprise. Shurtleff's attorneys had filed two different motions to dismiss on constitutional grounds in late June and early this month. And Davis County Attorney Troy Rawlings, who was prosecuting Shurtleff, responded with a motion to dismiss of his own. So we had been gearing up for an August 2nd hearing in front of Third District Court Judge Elizabeth Ruby Mills.
Right.
And instead she just, which she has the right to do, just made a decision on her own without hearing the arguments. She obviously had read the briefs. It's a bit interesting in that she dismissed on the state's motion. That would not be unusual that would carry more weight, but doing so forecloses Shurtleff from applying to the state to pay his legal fees.
If I'm not mistaken, there's a Supreme Court case that played a role in Troy Rawlings' decision to request a dismissal of these charges.
That's true. That's a unanimous 8-0 decision from June in the McDonald case. It's a Virginia case involving the governor and allegations that the governor took illegal gifts and money in exchange for favors, political favors. Troy looked at that and said that the court's ruling really narrowed the scope of what could be considered, inappropriate conduct by a public official. And he felt like that the three gift charges that he had really that cut out the meat of that for him. And so he didn't, as he's explained it to us, didn't really want to expend tax dollars needlessly when he felt like it was not a case that he could win.
You know, in the reporting you did yesterday, there were some fascinating hints at what might be ahead. Shurtleff made statements saying that there's a lot that hasn't come to light and that the media, the Tribune actually in particular, he said, has got the story all wrong.
Well, he actually said everybody got it wrong.
Okay.
And that contention is really based on his belief in what he says is the evidence that they have, that some of the core documents, statements, affidavits, and investigative work from police at the state and federal level who worked on this case for almost 4 years, made material omissions of fact, twisted the evidence, and in some cases outright lied in order to secure search warrants and go into his home and get his computer and build a case against him. So, and as it always is, when there are official documents like that, that becomes part of the predominant narrative, and that is something that gets repeated. Mm. I've actually had this argument over and over with his attorneys about, the characterization, for example, that there was a pay-to-play climate at the Attorney General's office is not a narrative that is easily escaped because that was the allegation. And we repeat those things as sort of a convention of the way journalism and reporting functions. And so I think those things have, from his point of view, have gone a long way towards damaging his reputation and his his record of public service over the life of his professional career, and he's mad.
Well, it's you mentioned the pay for play environment that is reported on and kind of repeated, and there's a difference between obviously the legal case and the allegations that were made even by state lawmakers. I mean, they had their own investigations.
They did. They had several investigations. The House did one. The Lieutenant Governor's office did one. The Attorney General's office contracted out for an independent investigation. All of those findings repeated similar themes that involved Mr. Shurtleff and also Mr. Swallow, his successor, John Swallow, whose case remains active.
Right.
So yeah, and I talked with Mark about that yesterday, and he's like, yes, but, I mean, it's true that those documents were produced, those investigations were produced, yes, but at the core of it, there's still some fundamental problems with the evidence and people, and so everybody got it wrong.
You know, you mentioned Shurtleff's successor, John Swallow, who's been wrapped up in these allegations as well. Is there a sense that you know, we'll see a dismissal in his case as well as a result of either, you know, that Supreme Court ruling or because of the evidence at hand?
Well, there is a motion pending, a dismissal motion brought by his attorney, Scott Williams. They believe that the evidence in his case has been tainted because the protected communications between Swallow and a previous attorney was commingled with other evidence, and so his constitutional rights have been violated. Those arguments were heard, oral arguments were heard on that a couple of weeks ago, and we're anticipating some sort of decision on or about August 12th. Sim Gill, in Salt Lake County District Attorney, he is adamant that that case is going forward, but certainly there's a decision in the judge's hands, and no one quite knows what she will do, so we have to wait and see.
You know, I mentioned the hints of things to come. Shurtleff is cooperating with investigators in cases building against, I guess, other entities. What are these other cases?
Well, so Troy Rawlings from Davis County, in his pursuit, part of the reason for the dismissal was his inability to obtain certain pieces of evidence or large pieces of evidence, actually, from the federal government, the U.S. Attorney's Office, the Department of Justice, Public Integrity Unit, and the FBI, who sort of began the investigation of Shurtleff and Swallow. Rawlings believes there's missing stuff and that he had a constitutional obligation to provide that to Shurtleff. So that is also one of the grounds for his dismissal. And that information leads him to other people, Jeremy Johnson being one.
Right.
There are questions about Swallow's involvement in a possible bribe of Nevada Senator Harry Reid, which Shurtleff actually reported to the feds, and there's some question about whether or not it was actually investigated.
Rawlings wants to speak with Senator Reid.
He does. He wants to speak with Senator Mike Lee because there were some improprieties potentially related to his campaign, which implicate Swallow and Johnson. And so Rawlings has, I know, already gotten some cooperation from Shurtleff in helping him sort of formulate a basis for where that investigation is going to go. He calls it Rogue Runner. And he has been seeking a state grand jury.
Okay.
And we expect Shurtleff to testify. And Shurtleff told me yesterday if called, he would testify. Same if he was called to testify in the Swallow case, he would tell the truth, testify and tell the truth.
Okay, and so that's, that's yet to be determined when and whether that will happen.
To get a state grand jury, you have to convince first a panel of judges that one is warranted. So Rawlings is in the process, I believe, of drafting the documents, the argument, if you will, to persuade them. And then if they agree, then they would impanel a jury of 9 to 15 people to hear testimony, and then we would see if any indictments would come from that. And all that would be done in secret. So, you know, how much we're going to know remains to be seen.
Government editor Dan Harry, I want to bring you in on this. This has been a drawn-out court case, but this kind of seems anticlimactic, which isn't to say good or bad, but just sort of a fizzle. Was this dismissal a surprise to you?
Well, I've read a lot of Jennifer's stories, so I guess it isn't in that respect because it's kind of been going in that direction for a while. But yeah, to look ahead from a year ago to see this would have been remarkable. You would have thought after the feds had passed on prosecuting this case that the state, the attorney, Troy Rawlings, who took it on, would have felt that he had a very solid case to go on. So, yeah, it's quite surprising.
You know, there are other stories that I do want us to get to, but and we don't have we only have a half an hour left in the show. But Jennifer or Dan, how has the office of the Utah Attorney General maybe changed in the wake of all of this? Has it, or how have politics in Utah changed?
I don't know if you might have more to say about this than I do because you've followed politics so much more closely.
Yeah,
I don't know if I can say about the AG's office. I mean, they tout themselves as being so much better than their two predecessors, both Shurtleff and Swallow. But in terms of how they are operating on a daily basis, I have get mixed reviews.
They're not really well open to the press.
Right.
I will say that. You know, it's oftentimes impossible, or very difficult or impossible to get an interview with the Attorney General. Hmm. They do most of their communicating with the press through press releases. Many of them are touting accomplishments of the office or of the Attorney General. And I know there have been some issues about campaign contributions. For instance, we did a story about large contributions from sort of some questionable sources. One of those was Washakie, the renewable energy company that's owned and operated by the Kingston family. Right. And it was the second story that we reported these large contributions that they said, okay, well, now there's a federal investigation going on of the company, so we'll put the money in escrow. The first time around that we reported this and some of the questionable dealings of the family in the past, you know, it didn't faze them at all. Hmm. So that's been surprising to me. I would have thought that given what Sean Reyes said during the campaign and sort of the attitude in the legislature, that we would have seen sort of an entirely different approach to, say, campaign fundraising and those issues after the Swallow and Shurtleff incident.
As a sort of reform initiative, as it were. Well, there's lots of great years of reporting, really, on this story available at sltrib.com, and it's you know, we wait to see what happens next. We do need to move on to some other stories. And Dan Harry, while I've got you in front of me, kind of a funny jump here, but something that Lee Davidson reported on this week were complaints about how taxi operators at the Salt Lake City International Airport are conducting business. People getting taken for a ride was the headline in the Tribune. What's this all about?
It's kind of the Wild West atmosphere that is become of the ground transportation situation at the Salt Lake City International Airport. Right now, there is no regulation of taxi fares outside of Salt Lake City. So there's a maximum if you're riding from the airport to somewhere within Salt Lake City. Other than that, a taxi can charge you whatever they want. And so it's a consumer beware issue where if you're going to grab a cab from the airport, negotiate your fare up front.
And especially, well, obviously, if you live outside of Salt Lake City, or Salt Lake City
right.
proper, especially,
right.
as there are caps, apparently, for the city, as you just said.
Yeah, I think it's a $35 cap if you're going somewhere within the city. Outside of that, it's entirely up to the cabbie.
Can you still, this is just out of curiosity, I mean, I know that ride-sharing companies play a role here, but in terms of cabbies, can you still negotiate, if you live inside of Salt Lake City and it's a $35 cap, can you still say, you know, I'm going to pay you $25?
You can negotiate. That's a cap. So some cab drivers have told passengers that that's a flat fee, and that's not true. Hmm. What Lee Davidson's story was based on was he did an open records request for all of the complaints filed with the airport.
Right.
And so he told some of the stories that passengers have complained about in their transportation, and some of them were, you know, quite disturbing. I mean, the amounts of money that they were charged. There was one incident where a cabbie pulled over for gas and asked the passenger for cash so he could put gas in the car, and then asked for more fare when they got to their destination. So, yeah, it's like I said, negotiate up front.
Well, it's an interesting story available there at sltrib.com, and surprising to me. But there is the role that ride-sharing companies like Uber and Lyft play here is that this, I guess this is sort of the result of allowing those companies at the airport. Is that part
of this? They were trying to change rules to allow for Uber and Lyft to operate there. And so they kind of had to deregulate the cab industry to do that. And just in the time that they've been there, Uber and Lyft now have about a third of the market share out from the airport. And I suspect that that will grow even larger.
You know, before we go to a break, speaking of transit-related items, Lee Davidson also reported, I think it was in this morning's paper, that the Utah Transit Authority is getting a $20 million grant from the federal government. What is this grant for?
It's to make acts more accessible, you know, at the track stations and bus stations to do some of the handicapped accessible and also just try to broaden the base of people who can get onto tracks and buses.
Okay, so some infrastructure spending, I guess some accessibility spending, who knows? We'll have to take a look at it, and you can find more at sltrib.com to determine more of that. A reminder to listeners that we'd love to hear your thoughts on the stories we're covering today. You can join us at 801-355-8255 or by commenting at sltrib.com. We're going to have to take another quick break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. When we come back, a look at efforts to recruit non-teachers to head Utah classrooms and more. Stay with us.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and the Utah Shakespeare Festival, presenting interactive green shows, play discussions, and other educational activities before and after the plays. Information at bard.org.
Hi, I'm Rachel Giza. He's known as the Jay-Z of soca music. Next time on Q, Trinidad's Michelle Montano will share his musical mix of Afrobeat, dancehall, and calypso. Plus, actor Bryce Dallas Howard will discuss her role in the fantasy film Pete's Dragon. That's coming up on Q from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at 1, right here on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm KCPW producer Roger McDonough, joined this hour by the Salt Lake Tribune's Dan Harry, Rachel Dobner, and by the phone by Rachel Piper. And we're digging into a review of this past week's news, but we do have some breaking news happening right now here at the Salt Lake Tribune, and that is Dan Harry, I'll turn to you for the scoop.
We've got some news that is important to us, and I think to a lot of people in Utah, and that's that our longtime publisher and editor, Terry Orm, is gone today under Paul Huntsman, the new owner. And Jennifer Napier-Pierce, who just recently left us for the University of Utah's Hinckley Institute of Politics, is coming back as editor.
And she was the former host of this program.
Former host of this program. And she's an excellent journalist, well-respected. And this is all just happening now. We had no idea of this when we walked into the studio today.
Okay, so this is obviously partially, I guess, a decision being made by Paul Huntsman, the new owner and publisher of the Salt Lake Tribune, but unexpected for you guys, for the Tribune staffers.
Very unexpected, very sudden.
And not unexpected, I think, that a new publisher would make changes, but we sort of got the initial message that Terry's leadership had, as it has been by all of us, long valued, and that he'd kept, you know, the boat steady from rocky years, for which we are deeply appreciative. So it's really hard to see him move on. Many of us are, you know, have him to thank for our very jobs, and me included. Mm-hmm. And it'd be really difficult to see him go.
Right. And Rachel Piper, we've got you on the line. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this as well. You know, Jennifer's saying that, you know, her job is owed to Terry Orm. How about yourself?
Yeah, Terry, you know, Terry's the one who hired me. I think he's the reason a lot of people stayed at the Tribune when things were looking pretty rough.
Yeah, and there have been some tough years, and we should say that that this is new local ownership after years of being the Tribune being owned by a hedge fund, a distant hedge fund. It's really interesting breaking news, and something that I'm sure the Tribune will cover itself. You guys do a good job reporting your own stories, so we'll keep an eye.
Well, better us than someone else.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's a lot of other stories that happened this week, and this is obviously interesting breaking news. But Rachel Piper, we've got you on the phone here from the Environment Desk this week. We saw a hearing in southern Utah on Wednesday on the proposed Bears Ears National Monument. This was something that Salt Lake Tribune reporter Brian Maffley covered. Who held this hearing, and who was in attendance?
Mike Lee held this hearing, a field hearing down at in Blanding, and most of the people in attendance, especially the witnesses, were folks who opposed the idea of having a Bears Ears National Monument, including Governor Herbert, obviously, Rob Bishop, San Juan County Commissioner Bruce Adams, and then two local Navajo who also opposed the monument.
Okay. And this is almost, you said this is entirely made up of people or made up of people who oppose the monument, kind of a counterpoint to a recent visit by Interior Secretary Sally Jewell and some meetings that she held, which featured, I'd say, more prominently proponents of the monument. Is that right?
Well, you know, some would argue that the Sally Jewell hearings were sort of come one, come all. You know, she heard from a lot of people who oppose the monument as well. You know, so Lyman featured prominently. I think they had 3.5 to 4 hours of very diverse comments at her hearing. This week sort of came, you know, it's during the Democratic National Convention. A lot of people who maybe supported the monument just chose not to come because they'd just been there.
Right.
They'd just been there to see Sally Jewell. And whether by design or coincidence, everyone who picked from the audience to talk was anti-monument.
You know, you mentioned the two local Navajo tribe members who, you know, like everybody else there, spoke against this monument. What was their position, and how does that contrast with other Navajos?
Their position is sort of that if the Antiquities Act doesn't really have a great history for Native Americans when it comes to sort of designated something that they find sacred and important and still, you know, used today, turning it into a national monument sometimes cuts them off from access. You know, currently they can go and forage, they can collect firewood for ceremonies and pine nuts and that kind of thing. And they argue that if it was a national monument, they would have to pay a fee to go see these lands that have been their families for generations, centuries.
Is that accurate?
It's hard to say. It certainly could be because the actual proposal to say, hey, give us this 1.9 million acre monument does include sort of not loopholes, but just ways for those activities to continue. However, if Obama comes in and says this is now the Bears Ears National Monument, there's nothing that says he has to use their proposal. He could do whatever he wanted. So that is a concern.
I'm a reminder to our listeners that we're speaking with Rachel Piper, environment editor at the Salt Lake Tribune. You know, you're mentioning these two Navajos. There's also a Navajo group that favors the monument designation. They didn't attend this hearing in Blanding because they say that it would be too one-sided, or that it was designed to be one-sided. Is that right?
Yes, they refused to attend, as did some others, saying that, you know, they have been the subject of sort of abuse and spurious allegations from the folks that oppose the monument, and they didn't really want to hear it anymore. They might have been on the right track there in opposing the monument. Herbert compared it to a political tomahawk, which is an interesting choice of words when you're talking about Native American landscapes.
Hmm. And so the governor at this hearing, I mean, yeah, comes out against the monument, which is obviously not unexpected and something that he has done in the past. Dan Harry, I'd love to actually bring you in on this as well. This is, of course, part of a larger public lands debate in the West, something that has led to conflicts. Is there, and actually anybody can weigh in on this, is there any common ground here? A monument is by its nature in Utah ever since, I guess, Grand Staircase Escalante, kind of a contentious thing.
Yeah, I think that there is some common ground here, and Brian Mathley has written about this to some extent, that we are to the point now where everyone concedes there is protection needed in the Bears Ears area. So now the argument is not whether there should be protection, but what form that protection should take, and also the size of the protected area set aside. And so it has moved the debate. I think this whole issue has moved it. I think the threat of a presidential act to create a monument has at least brought it to that point. Beyond that, there is no agreement. You know, so there is some common ground there.
You know, there's about 6 months left in President Obama's term, and I don't know, Rachel, Dan, anybody, what have we heard in terms of whether or not this monument is going to happen? Or, you know, do you guys have an office pool, for example? I'm curious.
I don't think we're allowed to discuss office pools on the radio. I know I wouldn't. But.
Okay. All right. Well, I mean, who knows? 6 months left, and we'll see what happens. You know, we don't have a lot of time left. And Rachel Piper, I do want to get on to other stories that that came from your desk this week, education and environment. Salt Lake Tribune reporter Benjamin Wood this week reported on a new rule adopted by the Utah School Board. What does this new policy do?
Basically, it's a secondary path to teacher licensing where if you are an expert in a field, you can, and you have a bachelor's degree, you can pass a background test, demonstrate you're knowledgeable in whatever that field is, and then become a teacher without having those licensing or going through an traditional education program, being a student teacher, all of that stuff. These teachers have to be mentored for 3 years by a veteran educator, and then they would be more qualified for another license. And so
A lot of Utah teachers, a lot of Utah educators aren't very happy about this new policy, correct?
Right. You know, the reason that they did this new policy is because Utah has a teacher retention problem. A lot of teachers leave the field. Fewer students are going into education in college. They want to bring in this new crop of teachers from other fields. Educators say this is going to you're not going to fix the problem with this. You're going to basically put a stick of dynamite in the hole, as one of the teachers who testified compared it to, because they say this is going to demoralize existing teachers. This is going to be asking even more of educators who are already, you know, working sun up to sundown in their classrooms to then also be training these inexperienced people from outside the profession.
This is maybe kind of a difficult question for you to answer, but what does this do to programs that that educate teachers at universities? I mean, university teaching, educating, or programs to train teachers at universities, does this sort of devalue them? If you don't need that degree to become a teacher, will you still go there?
Right. Well, so, you know, that's been the argument from some people. A professor at BYU, you mentioned that very thing, saying that, You know, those programs are already declining, and now if you can say, okay, I can go to college for 4 years, or I can take a little course online, I can pay $300, whatever, $1,000, get a course, figure out how to pass this test, and then be a teacher. I mean, why wouldn't you go to that second route, possibly a private route, moneymaker for some people, and then that leaves these Utah colleges even with lower enrollment in these education programs.
Is this, Rachel, policy now adopted and happening, or is there still time for public commentary?
I think there's still time for people to have their voices heard. It was officially approved in June. The state board will meet again in August, and at that point, if they don't change it, if they don't say, we're not going to do this, or we're going to tweak it in some way, it will just go into effect.
All right. Well, it's an interesting story. Coverage again at sltrib.com. Guys, we are low on time, and so I'm going to now take us to the final segment of the show, the underplayed stories of the week. And Rachel Piper, I'll stick with you. Do you have something ready for an underplayed story?
I do. Scott Pierce has a TV column this week with a preview of Sharknado, which is coming out on the Sci-Fi Channel this Sunday. Our own Gary Herbert has a cameo, and it is not to be missed. You can see a clip of it on our website. He actually fights off some of the Sharknado from his office in the Utah Capitol.
With a tennis racket.
Yes.
Worth checking out, definitely. Dan Harry, how about yourself? Underplayed story.
I'm just going to talk a little bit more about this change in leadership at the Tribune.
Please do.
So it looks like that Jennifer Napier-Pierce will take over in September as the editor. In the meantime, Tim Fitzpatrick, our assistant editor, will take over as interim editor.
Okay. Well, obviously, our congratulations to Jennifer Napier-Pierce and our best wishes to Terry Orm as editor. Interesting.
Absolutely. He was terrific. He was a brick. And as Rachel said, I think a lot of us are still there because of Terry.
Hmm. Jennifer Doebner, I don't know if you want to continue this theme or go to your own underplayed story of the week.
I won't say it's underplayed, but this morning in the federal court, Jeremy Johnson, a St. George businessman, is being sentenced.
Right.
And Jeremy's case is tied into the Shurtleff case, tied into the Swallow case, tied into the Lawson case, tied into the Mark Jensen, Sessions Jensen case. And it'll be interesting to see what happens there. A lot of the same evidence used in his case is also to be found in the Shurtleff and the Swallow cases. Some of the same problems and questions have been raised about that. And he was convicted of lying to a bank. He had been charged with over 80 counts. He beat most of them acting as his own attorney. But the federal government is looking to send him away for anywhere from 17 to 22 years, even though there are no financial losses in the case. So it would be really fascinating to see what the judge does today and what happens. Many people believe his case will be thrown out on appeal.
And there are jurors from this case who came forward and had complaints about how this went forward.
Yeah, there are several who have been talking to Tom Harvey. We believe that one will actually take action, formal action, with the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals, which has a process for filing complaints about federal judges. In fact, her long letter explaining her concerns about the treatment of the defendants by the judge and by the prosecutors and by gross representations in the case and another use of the term false narrative, which Mr. Shurtleff has used, have come up. The jurors were very, very, at least this juror and a couple of others, very, very upset. And her story is fascinating because you see how the conviction basically was negotiated between the jurors. It's quite interesting.
Interesting story, and we'll see. So how many years is he potentially facing?
17 to 22.
Wow. Okay, or could be thrown out on appeal. Well, I'll go for my underplayed story of the week. I'll go with a photo essay, actually, of a morning hike to Mount Timpanogos that appeared at sltrip.com. I can't remember who the photographer was.
Lenny Mahler.
Really remarkable photography, mountain goats, really early morning shots of Salt Lake City. Check it out at the Tribune's website, sltrip.com. Jennifer Doebner, Dan Harry, Rachel Piper, and earlier Thomas Burr, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thank you very much to all of you for joining us on the show today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
You're welcome. We will wrap up today with Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. This week, Kirby recounts his interaction with a Donald Trump supporter at a hotel in Montana. So since we last spoke, Donald Trump officially became the Republican Party's presidential nominee. Before that happened, though, a few weeks back, you ran afoul of a Trump supporter in a Montana hotel because you couldn't help provoking her, I guess. What happened there?
Essentially, it was her behavior. We were coming, my family and I were coming back from Canada, and we stopped in Butte for the night. Early in the morning, I'm an early riser, and so I got up and tiptoed out of the room so I wouldn't wake my wife up. Went looking for breakfast and ran across this elderly couple that was just really firing on this maid about a missing jewelry case.
Huh.
And which is,
basically, they were accusing her of having done something with the jewelry case.
Right.
Or, yeah, or being involved.
Her. So it really wasn't about the maid feeling bad that got me interested in the old couple. I just watched them, winding up, and I thought, man, I love making people like this even matter.
And you essentially wanted to push some buttons, make it...
Oh, yeah, right.
So the woman was chewing out this maid, and I guess having served an LDS mission in South America, you speak some Spanish, is that right?
Yeah, I lived in Spain for 4 years, too.
So you expressed something to the maid, which kind of maybe broke the tension for her, but not so much for the woman in question.
I just basically asked her what was going on, and then she told me where she was from and what the problem was. how she was feeling, and she was trying to explain how to get to the front desk, and these people were talking too fast for her, and I said, so what's this old witch's problem? And that made her smile, and boom, that lady, the older lady, was off to the races. She started screaming and flinging things around.
And what was, I mean, some of this is I don't want to make this political, but there are some anti-immigrant flames being
fanned by current political figures?
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to get at.
Okay, yeah. They were Trump supporters. The man in the elderly couple was wearing a Trump button, which, you know, didn't necessarily hold against him other than the fact that they were angry over something that seemed easy to fix.
Right.
For me. And so I thought, oh, what the hell? It's early in the morning. Let's have some fun. And
how did they respond to your sort of intervening in
well,
there?
They immediately identified me as on the maid side because I could speak Spanish.
Right.
And whatever it was that I said to her that they didn't know obviously made the maid smile. And suddenly she had two targets now. And so she starts screaming and yelling at me, but I wasn't a young woman who didn't speak the language.
I know that towards the end of your piece, essentially, you walk the woman down to the front desk.
We took them down to the front desk. Turned out that they had just had a customer turn in the jewelry case because it had been left on the serving line in the breakfast room. And there was no apologies to the maid or anything like that, but I couldn't resist. I had to keep after the old lady and even suggested that her husband punch her to shut her up, which was wrong, I know, but I couldn't help go with it. But the point of when I wrote this column was, yeah, we're all going to have differences, but do we have to resort to behavior like this in order to resolve them?
You know? Moral of the story is about button pushing or about Trump supporters or maybe about Robert Kirby himself?
There's a little bit of all of that in there, but how easily we allow other people to push our buttons. And turns out that in her case, it was really easy.
And then she also expressed some points about people returning to their home countries and learning to speak English and so on and so forth, right?
Yeah, she said, I still wish they'd all go back to Mexico. And I said, and they still wish they could punch you in the face.
Again, that's Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. You can find the full Kirby archives at sltrib.com and a lot more reporting, of course, as well. That's it for this edition of Behind the Headlines, a production of KCPW Public Radio, Utah Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks to Jesse Ellis at KCPW, Tom Williams and Connor Rivers at Utah Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune's Emily Means. Coming up next on KCPW, a look at unusual presidential candidates over the years. That is part of KCPW Presents, an hour of curated documentary picked by staff here at the station. Again, thanks for tuning in, and have a wonderful weekend, everybody.
My 13-year-old daughter is here, and I haven't seen her in a couple of years. I mean, she's been living with us, but I've only seen the top of her head and her thumbs for the last 2 years.
Join us next time for the Moth Radio Hour, true stories about modern life from a live show on Martha's Vineyard, from the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
Join us Saturday night at 6 on Utah Public Radio.
This week on Radiolab.
It's about pain and the body.
The imagination.
Faith.
I know. You've healed me so many times at so many different things.
Leave now in Jesus' name. Back won't be straightened in Jesus' name.
We've all heard stories about how faith heals.
Lo and behold, she was healed.
This week we wonder, how does that work?
There is a way that mommy's kiss is kind of a placebo effect.
Join us Saturday at noon on Utah Public Radio.
You're listening to Utah Public Radio, a statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences. KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSU FM Logan, also heard at upr.org.